Today's Taisho is on case 41 in the Mu Meng Kang, the Wu Men Kuang, the Gate of No Barrier. Bodhidharma's mind pacifying. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace as yet. I beg you, Master, please pacify my mind." "Bring your mind here and I will pacify it for you," replied Bodhidharma. "I have searched for my mind and I cannot take hold of it," said the second patriarch. "Now your mind is pacified," said Bodhidharma. Mumon's comment, that broken-toothed old Hindu came so importantly, thousands of miles over the sea. This was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple, who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Shasanro did not know the four ideographs. Mu Meng's verse, "Coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma, and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you." Today is the third day of our sesshin. This is always the day in which people begin to reach a point where they're very tired physically and mentally, but they begin to find a renewing energy. If that hasn't already happened, hang on, it's going to happen. You know, sesshin is way up to this mountaintop and a way down the mountaintop. Both are equally wonderful. This way of speaking is often applied to the Zen life as a whole. So basically people say that on your way to Daikensho, it's like going up the mountain. And then after Daikensho, you go down the mountain and it's even more wonderful than going up. But whether you're going up the mountain or down the mountain, this life of Zen is really quite wonderful. And sesshin is like a mountain too. You know, first day people come to sesshin and they still have many attachments in the world outside the Zendo. They have many concerns, their minds are busily thinking over matters. It's hard to detach or free yourself from all of this trivial material. But by the end of the first day, sometimes people's minds start to become clear and they start to be able to focus on their breath or on their koan. Eventually it becomes possible to concentrate a little. On day two of the sesshin, usually people are beginning to get physically tired. And by the evening of the second day, people sometimes have a real lack of energy. It's like very much sort of hanging on by your teeth. Now, hanging on by your teeth is not at all a bad thing. In fact, it's the only way anything can be accomplished. This is quite important. You know, when you read books on Zen, or if you get Tricycle magazine or one of the Buddhist magazines, or if you see books and you turn Buddhist books and you turn the cover over, on the back of the cover there's usually a smiling a Tibetan monk or a smiling Zen master, maybe laughing. And you might think, you know, oh, that's what I want to be, a laughing Zen master, you know. And, you know, it doesn't show the photograph with the man sitting there or the woman sitting there. It's covered with sweat, hanging on, thinking, ring the bell, ring the bell, you know. But that's where things get done. That's where something can happen. At the photo shoot, you know, when you wear your best robes and you are being posed in front of the camera, nothing can really happen, you know. It is true that if you practice, you will have a life of indescribable joy. I mean, Zen is not about austerities, it's about joy. It's about real joy. But real joy has no object. Real joy has no goal. It's just this beautiful moment, you know. So it's hard for human beings to have that insight or to experience that in their bones, in their blood, in their flesh, in their bones. Basically, we come to Sesshin and we sit on the cushion and we have to put ourselves in a situation where we are at risk, or we are in trouble, or we are having some difficulty. And this is the way we get to the third day. And on the third day, it's possible sometimes for people to feel a kind of renewing energy. You go to sleep day two and think, I don't know, I just do not know. You get up on the third day and sometimes you have this feeling like, wow, I feel better, I don't know why. But it's like this is the mountaintop. You know, when you begin to put aside your preconceptions and you begin to empty yourself out, you find that you have this these resources you didn't perhaps think you had. You know, and this is the top of the mountain. Now, once you're opening up to life energy, once you're opening yourself up to life in this way, you can feel a tremendous infusion of energy, and then it's possible to pursue your business with great effectiveness through the rest of the sesshin. So it's like we have to, you know, in Zen, we often talk about dying on the cushion. Dying on the cushion. This is a quite common metaphor for Zen practice. My second teacher, Webb Roshi, always used to say, you know, you have to die on the cushion. And I must say, I often felt like I was dying on the cushion, or wanted to die because I was in such pain. But something happens to a person who's really practicing. You know, it's very interesting. You sit down on the cushion day one and you're a human being. So you have a tendency to say things like, I'm just working from my own experience, you know, I've been doing this for about 30 years. And after my first sesshin, I would always think, you know, I would practice and go to sesshin. I'd always think, well, maybe this is the sesshin where I won't be in pain. You know, so maybe I'm finally there. Because I would look over at Genki Roshi and later at Webb, and they would be sitting there calmly, and I would think, well, maybe this is the one. You know, I've paid my dues. It's time for some payback. You know, so I'd sit on the cushion and I would think, and you know, if you begin to do a lot of sesshin, eventually the day will come where, you know, day one is not so bad. And you think, well, I think I've turned a corner, you know. And then day two is like, uh-oh. Now wait a minute, this wasn't supposed to happen. If you're more of a beginner, this experience happens like after the second sit. You get through the first night, and then you get up in the morning, and like by 11 o'clock, it's beginning to really be dramatic. And you know, we can spend a lot of time in a state where we're fighting our pain, and you know, the mind spins around in its own little world. You know, so we all react to this discomfort in different ways. Some people, you know, long for home. They sit and think, ah, you know, I'll be home, you know, back in my couch, you know, reading a book, you know. Or some people think of good times, you know. None of this works, of course. The pain is very persistent. And You know, people get mad, people get frustrated. Oh, I'll never wake up. This is impossible. This is crazy. You know, this is, you know, people go through all the psychological baggage that happens to be their karma in the presence of this experience. And, you know, basically you try this posture and that posture and this posture and that posture. But what really has to happen is that you have to die on the cushion. And you can't die any other way than to practice zazen. So you sit on the cushion and you watch your breath and you squeeze with your hara and the breath goes out, 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 out. And if you allow it to, the breath will take you to a place which is very still and immovable. And if you keep going to that place, eventually you'll find that your pain becomes more distant. You may also find that lots of things become more distant. And eventually, you know, if you throw yourself into that, you know, everything can appear to vanish. Body and mind and world can all drop away, and you're in deep Ushin. This is called dying on the cushion. See, in this state, you have achieved the death on the cushion. But you know, we have ideas about life and death, and then there's a reality. You know, one way to think about what we're doing is, you all know about shock, right? The shock syndrome. If you are hit by a car, or if you are basically injured in some dramatic way, people often report that they enter into a kind of out-of-body state. This is not something anybody wants to have happen, but many people report a kind of great calm, clarity, connectedness. This is a state of consciousness or a state of awareness that is not ordinarily accessible to people for complicated psychological reasons. But in a state of shock, people can enter into this expanded consciousness. It's like no longer identifying with the self, actually. It's like a self without being, it's like a consciousness without being rooted in a self. And people who have survived death experiences report all kinds of wonderful things. Well, one way to think about zazen is that this is like controlled shock. See? So we're actually sort of inducing a state like that. And it's we're not standing out on the highway and getting hit by a car, but we're doing something that actually produces a state of mind very much like that, that out-of-body, out-of-self experience. And it is actually very closely related to the experience of being in shock. So, you know, you sit on the cushion and basically, your body says, "Get up, man! This is crazy. You know, let's get out of here." And you know, some part of you says, "No, you're not going, and you're going to sit here, and you're not going to move." And eventually, there's like a little split, a little separation in your consciousness, and it gets bigger and bigger, and finally, you can look at yourself from a distance. This is the host and the guest, right? Just sitting in that condition where you want to move, your body's telling you to move, induces a kind of shock. And the shock consciousness is the bigger kind of, the host consciousness steps out and looks back. This is so valuable because the host consciousness is not a prisoner of cultural conditioning and personal psychology in the way that the small self is. So now there's a self that can is connected to everything, not anchored in this particular person's life history, this particular person's likes and dislikes. This is this great death is a wonderful thing because it gives us access to this consciousness, which is not rooted in all of these little rooms we have created inside ourselves. And the host can help the guest free himself, free herself. See, host has this big consciousness that little self doesn't have. And little by little, host helps out guest, and they're reunited. This is called Daikensho. So what we're doing is very much a matter of inducing kind of shock-like experience in order to enter host consciousness. If you are feeling that your practice is not going somewhere, you just have to escalate the shock factor. Now, Buddhism is not about being miserable, or it's not about austerities, but it is about entering this state where the small self drops away. So if you're on your cushion and you're thinking that your practice is flat or lifeless, if it doesn't seem to be going somewhere, it's because you've grown comfortable. You know, it's possible after 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 sesshin to get a system going where you you come and you know how to get through all of this, and you're sort of buzzing along, and you're not actually very happy, but you're not actually very miserable. And one sign that you're in this state is that there's a lot of intellectual stuff going on in your head, where you're looking at yourself and you're evaluating and you're second-guessing yourself, and a lot of thinking goes on the cushion. Now, if you're in that state, you need the help of the host. And the only way to encounter the host is to do something nutty, like sit through the bell. So, you know, we have a half hour, this morning we had a 40-minute sit initially, and then we had about a 30-minute sit, you know. So if you want to improve your practice, what you do is you wait for the bell to ring and then you don't move. Now, let me just say, if you're a beginner, if this is your first sesshin or your second sesshin, I'm not urging you to do this. You know, just survive. That's good enough. And do your best. Work on your breath. But if you've been practicing for a while and you feel that your practice, if you're in your head too much, it's never productive. You know, the mind that is reflecting, analyzing, and so on is not a samadhi mind. That's not the host, that's the guest. The presence of the host is identifiable by the absence of cognition. So the absence of any kind of introspection is a sign that the host has arrived. In Buddhism, we call this Tathagata. This means thus, pure thusness. Tathagata, just this, see. The Buddha was so remarkable in his recognition of his awareness or living in Tathagata. People actually called him Tathagata. He was pure thusness, thus come, thus arrives. So, you know, if you're in a doldrum, if you're feeling that your practice is going nowhere, the answer is very simple. Escalate your practice. You know, sit through the bell. And that's a perfect state, see? That's the perfect state. You sit through the first sit and you think, okay, I've made it through. Now, what you want to do is go, okay, I'm going to rest for a minute. But if you don't do that, you know you've got another sit. You know, you don't really know how long it's going to be. You don't know if you can make it. So it's like walking a tightrope, right? You could fall off, you know, it's going to be painful, you know, your legs could really start hurting, and so you just hang on to mu, or you hang on to your breath for your dear life. You're like a man or a woman hanging by the skin of your teeth. See, and that is perfect. That's how people make progress. Only, you know, humans are so fearful and so clinging. We're so frightened and we're so fearful that it's very hard for us to really let go and just be in the moment. You know, it takes that condition where we're hanging by the skin of our teeth to really experience joy, real joy. You know, there's pleasure, there's happiness, and there's joy. Pleasure means you're doing something that is gratifying. Happiness means you're living pretty much the life you wanted to live, maybe. But joy means it's just the welling up of pure happiness, pure without any conditions. You know, I don't know why I'm happy. I'm just so happy. Joy is like unbounded and unconditional connection to life. It's our natural state, but we're often not in a state of joy because we make so many arbitrary distinctions. So, you know, when you're on the tightrope, when you're sitting there thinking, all right, I'm going to go for it, I'm going to go for a second sit, you know, in that state, something wonderful can happen. Real joy can enter into your heart, into your consciousness. And the whole time, it's like if you just get through the next breath and the next breath, and then there's no time for thought, see? That's real practice. Let me just get through this next breath. And you hang on to each breath for dear life. See, in that condition, there's no room for you to go, I wonder if this is really working out. You know, why am I not making more progress? You know, those kinds of thoughts are a sign that you're not in the host mind. And the only way to get into the host mind is to put yourself on the tightrope, so to speak. There's no other way. You can't will yourself to do it. You can't sit there and go, all right, I'm getting these thoughts out of my head right now. See, that's if you haven't discovered that, you know, that's not going to work. And you can't say, all right, enlightenment, here I come, you know. You can't, you know, bolster yourself and sort of rally your emotions or your will. That's the most absurd, isn't it? The only way to do it is to go out on the tightrope where you're hanging by your teeth and you're saying, just let me get through the next breath. Perfect, perfect. Then real joy can happen to you. It's a big problem for people who have been practicing for a long time that they avoid this condition. Master Linji used to get furious. He used to come into the Zendo and he was associating with Zen professionals. These were all people who had chosen a life of monks or nuns, and they could go through sesshins. They could do a sesshin, you know, with one hand tied behind their backs. You know, it was a cakewalk for them because they had been sitting for so long. You know, they knew how to avoid compromising situations. But they couldn't wake up because all they were doing was getting through. Linji's method was to, you know, smack people in the face and hit them in the head, and do anything to get them out of that, you know. That state of being right on the edge is so close to, you know, really being right on the edge of, you know, disaster is very close to joy, right? I mean, There's a fine line. All of a sudden you slip from the guest in trouble, right, to the host. And that is the great death, that moment. And you can tell you're in the host consciousness because of the joy, the happiness, and the you know, it doesn't matter. My legs hurt, so what? So what? You know. And there's no evaluating mind. This is just paradise. It's so simple. It's so hard for us to accept the sheer simplicity of this, you know. Bodhidharma was the Indian monk who brought Zen to China. Bodhidharma, Dhammo, or Dharuma, was a great yogin. He was really the master of this kind of meditation practice. He was really not a scholar, but a great meditation practitioner. And he came to China. He didn't bring his library. He brought one sutra, the Lankavatara Sutra, which we will talk about someday. But mostly he just brought Zazen. And when he came to China, he had a chance to present to his teachings to the Emperor of China. So he was very highly regarded in India. And when he got to China, he was brought before the emperor, and he completely left the emperor unimpressed. You know, he didn't say, I have mystic mantras, we have special visualizations. He didn't say, cultivate this, you know, do this, do that. You need a special kind of robes, you need this. The emperor said, what do you teach? What kind of holiness do you teach? And Bodhidharma said, not holiness, great emptiness, mushin. Not holiness, great emptiness. The emperor didn't understand this. And Bodhidharma left and went up to a cave and sat in a cave for 9 years practicing Zazen. This is called Piquan, sitting facing the wall. All of you are facing the wall too. It's the wall between life and death. It's the wall between host and guest. And he sat there, didn't go looking for disciples and so on. One day, a person shows up. A person whose name was Wei Ko, in Japanese he's often called Eka or Shinko, but basically he was a very learned person, very scholarly man, who had studied all the Confucian classics and all the wisdom of his culture and was totally unimpressed or unhappy person, you know. None of this brought him a joy. He was distinguished, he was highly regarded, but no joy, you know. So the absence of this really drove him to desperation. You know, he just kept getting entangled in more and more nonsense, more and more pointless struggles. You know, you can imagine, you know, the life of most scholars in China was a life at the court. So everybody's sort of apple polishing around the emperor, and learning is just a weapon or a tool or an adornment that kind of a culture. And it's not used particularly to help people. So at any rate, the second patriarch, as he's called, became very desperate, and he went around China looking for somebody who could liberate him. And everybody just had another viewpoint, another philosophy, another proposition about the afterlife or this or that or whatever. And immortality was that Taoists were all selling immortality. So none of this had any produced freedom, produced joy, just another viewpoint, just another philosophy, just another value system. So, you know, basically he was in despair and actually thought about killing himself. But somebody said, do you know there's this Indian monk who's living up on this mountain, and he's in a cave. Why don't you go see him? His name is Bodhidharma. So Bodhidharma was sitting there year after year. Peasants in the town nearby would bring him food periodically so he didn't starve to death. And basically the second patriarch shows up at the cave of Bodhidharma. Now in this mythological encounter, Bodhidharma is supposed to have turned him away and said, I don't think you're serious. And so Shinko Eka cuts off his arm to show that he's serious. And Bodhidharma says, oh, okay, I guess you're serious. I guess you're reasonably serious. You can stay. And then they have this famous exchange which goes like this. He says, I'm in hell. Now, I'm in hell. Everywhere I turn, I am oppressed, and I'm unhappy. You know, I keep looking for something restlessly, and I can't find it. All I find is my own limitations, my own mortality, my own vanity, my own selfishness. You know. Bodhidharma says, bring your mind here, and I will pacify it for you. Now, what happens is that basically he says, stop being the guest. Look, stop paying attention to your thoughts. Look at where your thoughts are coming from. See, stop being swept forward by your mind. Look at mind itself. And if you watch the breath, eventually it takes you to a blank space. Actually, if you focus the mind intensely on anything, it enters into a state of blankness or darkness. This is Mu Xin. And this is the Buddha itself. Now, when people first encounter Mu Xin, they don't appreciate it. You know, they enter that blankness and think, well, that's nice. But where's the enlightenment, see? That's because when we start practicing, our senses are so coarse. We are so callous and coarse, so hard-hearted. We can't appreciate this amazing fact that consciousness automatically moves toward this darkness, this blankness. If we live a life of Zen, we live in Mu Xin. You dwell in Mu Xin. And the deeper you go into Mu Xin, the deeper your awakening will be. So a person who is just dipping his toe in Mu Xin is going to get a little bit of insight, a little bit of joy. But if you really plunge into Mu Xin, it's a boundless joy. So there's no way to go into Mu Xin, however, without a certain amount of discomfort. That's just a fact. You know, so if you sit through the first sit and you go into the second sit, you feel restless and restless and restless. What you've got to do is focus on your breath with your whole being and resist the desire to move. Hold the mind on the breath, don't move the body. Go with the breath and then follow the breath out to that blankness. Even the desire to move is a kind of idea or impulse. Don't allow even that to arise. Keep pushing your mind back into that blankness. Then deep Mu Xin. Deep Mu Xin, and what will happen is absolutely certain. Is the door will open inside of you and this great energy will pour forth. See, if you've encountered that blankness even once, you have already encountered mu xin. You have already encountered mu. But if you're practicing with the mu koan, if that's your koan, you have to deepen your experience of mu until you become mu itself, until there's no boundary between yourself and mu. You go into that blankness and you come out. You go into that blankness and come out. And that's still playing the role of the guest. You must become mu itself with your whole being. That means you go into that blankness and you stay there. You go into it with the next breath. You go in with the next breath. You don't allow a thought to take root in your mind. Just blank, 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 blank. And it's like being in a cave. When you go into a dark cave, at first you can't see anything. But little by little you develop the ability to see in the cave. This is just how it is when we go into the cave of mu, of mu. You go into the cave and you dwell there, and you gradually are transformed into a Buddha. This is one way to think about it. This is what practice is all about, entering the cave of mu and gradually returning to our original nature, which has no birth and no death, which you never get old and has never been born. This is amazing and a joyous, infinite life. Somebody asks you, what is Buddhism about? Infinite life. Infinite life. The door to infinite life is mu xin. Mu xin. So, the presence of thought, the presence of reflection, of value judgment, is an indication you're still playing the role of a guest. Don't be the picky guest who comes and goes, I don't think the towels are fluffy enough. You know, it's okay. The accommodations are okay, but be the host. Be the host. But, you know, this little story is telling you the truth. It's kind of a ridiculous story. He cuts his arm off. But you have to cut your arm off. That's all it takes. It's not a big price to pay. Please don't literally do any harm to your body. That's not appropriate. Always take the best possible care of your physical self. The point is, when you sit on the cushion and part of you says, I'm going to move, you haven't cut off your arm. You haven't died on the cushion. Now, we're all human beings. Sometimes you just throw in the towel and that's okay. Don't beat yourself up. That's also a kind of guest behavior. If you get thrown off your horse, you know, you dust yourself off and you get back on. That's okay. There's no disgrace in that. Everybody's reached a wall and they can't go on sometime. You take a break, you get back on your cushion, and you go for it again. So, you know, being thrown down is no disgrace. And we've all been thrown down by pain and fatigue and so on. That's you should never feel ashamed. But, you know, when you come to that line, when you come to that wall, and you feel you can't go on another breath, and then go on another breath, and go on another breath. This is how Buddhas are made. This is how the Shakyamuni, Siddhartha Gautama, was a human being, just like you and me. You know, he had hunger. When it was cold, he shivered in the cold. He almost starved to death. He got sick. He didn't fly through the air. Deeply awake, and he did it the same way you're doing it. Sat on the cushion, entered deep mu xin, watched the breath until he disappeared. And when you disappear, the host has arrived. Live the life of the host. This is the Zen life. So today is the third day. Anything can happen if you enter the host with your whole heart. So please, this morning, magnificent practice in this zendo. But don't be afraid to cross that line. Don't be afraid to go the next minute of sitting. Your fear is also just an illusion. Bodhidharma sat facing the wall. The second patriarch stood in the snow. He cut off his arm and presented it to Bodhidharma, crying, "My mind has no peace. I beg you, Master, free my mind. Bring your mind here and I will free it for you," said Bodhidharma. "I have no mind," said the second patriarch. "Now your mind is free. Now you're free." Mumon's comment, "That broken-toothed old Hindu came so importantly, thousands of miles over the sea. It was raising waves where there was no wind. In his last years, he induced enlightenment in his disciple who, to make matters worse, was defective in the six roots. Why, Shasanro did not know four ideographs." In other words, Bodhidharma liberated many, many people, freed them from discriminating intellect. Mumon's verse, "Coming east, directly pointing, you entrusted the Dharma and trouble arose. The clamor of the monasteries is all because of you." You. It's easy to imagine Buddha, great Buddha. When you enter Mushin, you are Buddha. So please, today, be Buddha.